Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president Local 237 Teamsters. Back again, very special guest, Congressman Dan Goldman. Dan Goldman represents New York's 10th Congressional District, covering Lower Manhattan and Western Brooklyn. He has held that office since 2023. He is a member of the House Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees, where his investigative knowledge and experience are most valuable. Before joining Congress, Dan spent 10 years as a prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. He also led the first impeachment investigation of Donald Trump for abusing the power of his office for his own personal gain. In Congress, Dan has continued to hold Trump accountable in an effort to preserve and protect our democracy. He stood up to the administration's lawless policies and practices. He successfully sued the Trump administration to halt ICE policies of blocking congressional oversight visits, one of the many ways he has been successful. Dan has a long distinguished record of fighting for working families. He is an original co-sponsor for the Medicare for All and Green New Deal, a longtime champion of universal child care, and co-founder of the Congressional Dads Caucus to prioritize the needs of working parents. Dan has sponsored countless pieces of progressive legislation that includes taxing the wealthy and addressing inequity. His own bill would make the ultra-wealthy pay their fair share, which would generate about $30 billion revenue per year. In addition to proudly serving the communities of Lower Manhattan and Western Brooklyn in Congress, Dan spends his time rooting for the Knicks and Liberty and raising his five children with his wife, Karini. Congressman, welcome back to Reaching Out. Thank you for taking the time to be on.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Greg.
Listen, I want to start, since we booked this show, we've had a couple of tragedies. We had two shootings by federal agents, one ICE shooting. ICE represented 50% of the shootings to this date in Minnesota. They've had two shootings, one is ICE, and it's unfortunate. Do you want to say something about that, or is it too early to tell because the investigations aren't concluded?
Look, I wish there were an actual investigation that was going on, but the FBI has excluded the state and local police from investigating this. They've claimed it as their own. And as we know, in the aftermath, Donald Trump, Stephen Miller, Kristi Noem all immediately concluded that the officer was acting in self-defense, and I guess the new term they seem to use both in Minnesota and in Oregon is weaponizing a vehicle, and therefore he was completely justified in doing what he did. It is outrageous, Greg, and it is the next step, sadly not surprising, and in my view expected, of a lawless ICE secret police immigration dragnet, which has been terrorizing our cities for months now. Going after not convicted criminals, but going after people with jobs who are law abiding, many of whom are actually here legally because asylum is a legal pathway. And they are coming in as a militarized law enforcement agency for civil enforcement. These are not criminals who they are arresting. And they're escalating violence. They're inciting and inflaming violence. And it is not surprising that we now have seen what was just an outright murder. And as more and more videos are coming out, it's become clearer and clearer that it is obvious that the driver, Renee Good, mother of three, was turning her wheel to get away and to leave, as one of the agents was telling her to do when she was shot three times in the face in cold blood. It is inexcusable. There must be accountability. And it is just more of a cover-up by this administration, which they've been doing with the Epstein files, which they've been doing with January 6th. This is the MO, and it normalizes violence by the government, and it is scary and dangerous.
One thing I've learned over the 30 years with the union, 10 years in law enforcement, that's 40 years. Get the facts before you speak. I was taught that when I came to work for the city and when I was 21 years old, working as a peace officer in the hospitals. Get the facts. No matter what the story is, the first thing you're supposed to do is get the facts, all of the facts. And sometimes facts take time. You have time, you got to get the facts. If it's a fluid situation, that's a different story. But you always have to be able to explain your actions. And if you go slowly, you can always make a statement, but you don't have to make it right away. And I could not believe, and I don't say this, and I'm usually not critical, of the amateur job being done by people who are being placed in law enforcement. Cash Patel, when Charlie Kirk was shot, announced that he had a suspect. And when he described the suspect, I said, there's no way a man of that age could have done what he did and jumped down off a building and got away. And right. I'm not even there. And of course, he was not the suspect. I said, what an amateur job. And now I see Christy Noem. What an amateur job. You never speak before you get the facts. You're halfway across the country. It happened where you weren't. You get the facts. To exclude the state from investigating, thinking you're going to be the only investigative body, the FBI, I would not want to be in that position. The more eyes, the better it is for everyone.
But that's if they're operating in good faith, Greg, and they're clearly not. And it's clearly Cash Patel. Cash Patel's an extension of Donald Trump, and he's now been given instructions not to charge this person. And there's no chance that this investigation is going to yield to any charges with this Trump administration that has completely politicized criminal justice and law enforcement.
And what happened, and I saw it, I'm just sick. And Cash Patel was born in New York. He was actually born in Nassau County. Mm-hmm. Same hospital in Nassau that my children were born in.
Oh, wow.
They're in the similarities, but I am just embarrassed. I'm appalled and not surprised because we knew what would happen. But for those of you who are waking up and surprised and disappointed and everything else, I can say I'm not surprised. I'm not disappointed. This is what I expected. And unfortunately, this is where we are. And if you think you're going to travel around the world and you're going to be accepted, we used to be accepted going to places around the world. Not anymore.
We're the laughing stock now.
Yeah.
Even the German, I don't know if you saw the German president yesterday basically said that we cannot look to the United States anymore to be a leader of the broad coalition of democracies around the world, and that they're already preparing to move away from us and to move on. It is absolutely unconscionable, and the damage is getting more and more permanent.
Yeah, we are really, really find ourselves by ourselves. So I know that you are working to combat wealth inequity and make American dream a reality. Toward that goal, you recently introduced the Robin Hood Act. Could you tell us how this legislation and how it would help average Americans?
Yeah, we've been doing some research. My staff, my excellent staff, has been doing some research over the last year or so, and we have uncovered that billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and other founders of companies that have their wealth in stock are avoiding paying tax because they take loans out against their stock. Rather than sell their stock and accrue capital gains tax, they take loans using the stock as collateral. So Jeff Bezos has an effective tax rate of 1%, and Elon Musk has an effective tax rate of 3%. If they were to pay capital gains tax and pay their fair share, I mean, you could argue that's not even their fair share, but even just get up to capital gains tax, that would generate almost $30 billion of revenue. And this is not just for them, it's for anybody who uses this this tax avoidance effort. And that could pay for universal childcare plus leftover money around the country. And so what I'm focused on, because what we are seeing is the minimization of the middle class. Wealth inequality is expanding rapidly. And people, too many Americans, too many working families, just don't even have access to the American dream. They are struggling to make ends meet. They have to choose between prescription drugs and food. The healthcare is not adequate. Nobody can concentrate on a career, nor are they provided with the proper education to really boost them. And so what we need to do is both solve this wealth inequality so that everybody is paying their fair share, and then help the programs like universal child care, like a Medicare for all, like our public education, like building housing and rent relief, so that we give everybody a higher floor so they can focus on achieving the American dream. And this bill is a critical start to that because it generates so much revenue that we can then use for some of these other programs.
Affordability and housing and insecurity are words we hear a lot today as the biggest problems that need to be addressed both locally and nationally. Let's start with housing. You have 31 NYCHA developments in your district. What have you done to improve public housing conditions?
Greg, since I got into office, NYCHA public housing, Section 8 housing has been a top priority of mine. We launched my campaign this week, and we had almost 100 members from about 10 different NYCHA developments there who I have really built close relationships with. And what I am doing is trying to work on the national, federal, larger level, but also on the ground. And in my 3 years in office, we have resolved 374 NYCHA cases, where residents are coming to us with problems, big and small, that we are taking care of. And it's a huge priority. But we also need to recognize that there are broader problems than the day-to-day. And it is essential and it is necessary in this country for our public housing residents to live with high quality housing, to live with dignity, and also for the workers who are there to be safe. And so we are focused very much on the ground, but we are also really pushing for accountability. NYCHA and its finances are somewhat of a black hole. And I think a lot of people recognize that the money is not used efficiently. It is not used as well as and productively as it should. And so as a former prosecutor, accountability is a huge part of my approach. And so we've been engaged in numerous conversations with leadership of NYCHA, trying to get to the bottom of some of their problems, fix some of their problems, help them brainstorm and target the major problems. And ultimately, I will continue to work at the federal level. I'm the leader of the capital improvement bill, the Public Housing Emergency Response Act, which would provide more than $30 billion for capital improvement to NYCHA. And Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez and I share that bill, and we are pushing, and we are, encountering a ton of resistance from Republicans who have demonstrated that they are much more interested in attacking our working families, in helping their billionaire buddies with tax cuts, not following through on the promises to make life more affordable for Americans. And that's where I'm trying to be creative and thoughtful and fighting for our working families.
Now, when you were in the Southern District, Were you there when there was, I would say, a raid on the gangs and drug dealers in NYCHA? I think it was an arrest of something like 150 people in one day.
Yeah, there was, I do recall a case along those lines. I was not personally involved in it. But there's got to be a balance, and we do need to make sure that our streets are safe, our developments are safe, that we're keeping gang influence out. And it's actually another thing that I've been working a lot on the ground with a bunch of community-based organizations, including those that are violence interrupters who are going into our NYCHA developments. Working with people, trying to understand what the appeal and attraction is to gangs so that we can counter it and that we can be providing a lot more of alternative pathways, because math and English is not for everyone, and we got to recognize that. And, you know, I think unions, in my mind, and vocational education have to be a much more prominent pathway for those who are not interested in math and English. And you can live a really full, meaningful, middle class life going towards that union route. And that's why unions are so important, is to provide that baseline and to provide that opportunity to, you know, get that house if you want to live in the suburbs in New York City, get that apartment, whatever it may be. But that's the type of thing that I'm working with a lot on the ground organizations who are focused on this. And we know it works. I introduced something called the Prosper Act, which would add $100 million of grant money to small community-based organizations that have proven to be successful at combating gun violence and keeping our kids on the straight and narrow. And it's just woefully underfunded, and there just isn't money. And that's why we need to be able to scale up, and that's why I'm pushing this bill.
You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President Local 237 Teamsters, with a very special guest, came back again, Congressman Daniel Goldman. And we're talking about what he's doing in Congress. And it sounds like a lot, and we have a lot more. I mean, I'm getting exhausted just listening to everything. I don't know how you find the energy with five kids to do everything you're doing, but you're just extraordinary. What about affordability? How we can bridge the gap between the two groups of Americans, the haves and have-nots. As you know, historically, the labor movement has spent decades fighting on behalf of working families, helping to create a middle class. What role do you see organized labor as having now, this time in American history?
I actually think, well, I shouldn't say more than ever. I mean, when unions were first created and were provided that base level of proper care and workplace conditions and proper wage, that it was a huge step. But right now, it is so important, because what we are seeing is those who are at the top and those who have assets, are their wealth or stock or whatever, their wealth is skyrocketing. And if you are a wage earner, your wealth has stagnated, and relative to inflation, it's actually gone down. And we cannot live in a society where those at the top are getting exponentially more wealthy, while the vast majority are struggling to make ends meet. And so you look at CEO pay compared to, you know, the average worker in these companies. And I mean, it has literally exponentially increased over the last 30 years. So the unions raising the minimum wage, making sure that we have fair contracts, that everybody has health insurance, the basic needs are more important right now than they have been in decades. And so my concern in Washington and beyond is that this administration especially is going after our public sector unions. And it is essential that all unions, public and private, have to stick together and not allow any of us to be picked off, because it is that unity and that solidarity. Even if they're not going after you today, they'll be going after you tomorrow. And that's why I've been such a huge supporter of the labor movement, because it is a critical, critical part of the solution to the mass wealth inequality that we're seeing. I talked about the Robin Hood Act. We do need our wealthy to pay their fair share, but we also need to be creating pathways for success. And unions do that as well or better than anyone.
I was a senior in high school when Ronald Reagan was elected. He came up with the trickle-down theory. And as a senior in high school, I knew nothing trickles down, because if somebody gives me something, I'm not going to give it to somebody else. And the money just stayed at the top. And that's where it started. And it just got worse over the next four decades. So when we want to know where that theory came from, it came from Ronald Reagan. And his words, I remember, trickle down. I said, nothing trickles down except for water. So, yeah, I mean, that's where that came from. So,
and it's been proven over and over not to be the case. And if you look at the presidencies over the last 40 years at job growth or reduction, Democratic administrations have created tens of millions more jobs than Republicans have, because trickle-down economics does not work.
Sure, sure. No one wants to say it, no one wants to admit it, but the Democratic administrations create jobs, bring down debt, and I could point to Bill Clinton, I could point to Barack Obama, I could point to Joe Biden. Despite what the narrative is, the Republicans are better with the narrative, because people believe their lies. I mean, that's all I can say. You rather believe it's sensationalized. You rather read this fiction book. But the reality is, you're better with Democratic governments, because the jobs are created. And that's just a fact. And anybody wants to debate me on facts, you know, facts are there. You don't read them. It's so bad that this administration does not want to release the job numbers. Now, if I'm doing a good job, I want people to know about it. So I'm not going to hide it. That's the tell all there. They don't want to release the job numbers. But we have 2 minutes. In 2 minutes, I want to give you time to say whatever you want to say, because I'm going to dispense with the questions. I don't want to waste precious time, because airtime is special. What do you want to say to our audience in 2 minutes?
Well, I want to say that I am very optimistic about the Knicks, Greg.
Oh.
And feeling like, you know, they're starting to come together. Mike Brown has been a real blessing to this team. Obviously, in a little bit of a lull over the last couple weeks, but that's going to happen during the season. And I'm excited about the playoffs. What are you thinking?
I am thinking that they got me back. When they lose, I don't sleep at night, and I will not be satisfied till they win the championship. If they don't win the championship, I'm instructing my kids to bring my championship t-shirt to wherever I may lay. Because I did not get any gear from the Emirates Cup, because that's not my goal. I still have my 1999 Eastern Conference Championship t-shirt and hat. And I have not worn it, because I'm still waiting for that championship. But I did buy it, because I said, this is maybe as far as we could get for my lifetime. But I am optimistic about them. And I'm saving money for that championship game, because I don't care what it costs me. I'm just going to save it and get me a seat in the rafters for that championship game. I will be there.
You got to be there. Exactly. Yes. Well, hopefully we're going to get there, and I'm optimistic.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President Local 237 Teamsters. With us, very special guest was Daniel Goldman, avid Knicks fan like myself. And thank you for watching and listening.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Teamsters Local 237.